and the interstitial spaces between the cells. This makes it much easier to extract flavor when the spice is subsequently ground and incorporated into your food. Second, toasting also catalyzes a whole cascade of chemical reactions that produce hundreds of flavorful byproducts, greatly increasing the complexity of the spice. When toasting pre-ground spices, this latter reaction will definitely occur, but you've also got a problem: vaporization. The flavorful compounds inside spices are generally quite volatile. They desperately want to escape into the air and fly away. With whole spices, they remain relatively locked down. They can't escape very easily from their cellular prisons. With ground spices, on the other hand, there's nothing holding them back. They'll very rapidly fly into the air. You may have noticed that pre-ground spices become far more aromatic as you toast them. Remember this: if you smell it while you're cooking, it will not be in your food when you serve it. There are rare exceptions to the toast before grinding rule. Indian and Thai curries, for example, start with ground or pureed aromatics sautéed in fat. Because most of the aromatic compounds in spices are fat-soluble, they end up dissolved in the fat, flavoring the rest of the dish evenly and easily when other ingredients are added. But for the vast majority of applications, and any time you're going to toast your spices dry, make sure to do it before grinding them. Dried chilies. Dried chilies come in a range of flavors and heat levels. To help make selection easier, I've broken them down into a few categories. The ideal chili should combine elements from several of them: sweet and fresh, distinct aromas reminiscent of red bell peppers and fresh tomatoes. These peppers include costeño, New Mexico, aka dried Anaheim, California, or Colorado, or corichero. Hot, overwhelming heat. The best, like cascabels, also have some complexity, while others, like Pekin or Arbol, are all about heat and not much else. Rich and fruity. Distinct aromas of sun-dried tomatoes, raisins, chocolate, and coffee. Some of the best-known Mexican chilies, like ancho, mulato, and pasilla, are in this category. Smoky. Some chilies, like chipotles, smoked dried jalapenos, are smoky because of the way they are dried. Others, like Nora or Guajillo, have a natural, musty, charred wood smokiness. Vegetarian chili. Why does vegetarian chili get such a bum rap? I mean, there's the obvious. Chili is a divisive issue, especially among those who love chili. But hey, guess what? Beans can taste good in chili. Tomatoes can taste good in chili. Heck, even pork and tomatillos can taste good in chili. So why shouldn't we be able to make a completely meatless version that tastes great as well? I've seen a few decent vegetarian chilies in my lifetime, but for some reason, they all seem to fall into the 30 minutes or less camp. That, in and of itself, is not a bad thing. Vegetarian chili, as a general rule, doesn't need to be cooked as long as meat-based chilies, because vegetables, especially canned beans, tenderize faster than meat. But long, slow cooking nets you benefits in the flavor department. Fast chili recipes are inevitably not quite as rich and complex as you'd like them to be. My goal was to create a 100% vegetarian, actually it's vegan, chili that has all of the deep flavor, textural contrast, and rib-sticking richness that the best chili should have. First things first, faux meat is not in the picture. I want my vegetarian chili to celebrate vegetables and legumes, not to try and imitate a meaty chili. With that out of the way, we'll move on to the second thing. Great chili has to start with great chilies. That's what it's all about. I've seen recipes calling for just a couple tablespoons of prefab chili powder for an entire pot of beans and tomatoes. The only way to achieve great flavor is to blend up the chilies yourself, starting with whole dried chilies. And we've already got a great recipe for a complex chili paste devised for the meat chili, so why not use it here as well? Next up, the beans. For me, a great chili has to show some character and diversity. You don't want completely uniform beans in every bite. You want a range of textures. Here's where you've got to make some creative choices. Many vegetarian chilies take the kitchen sink, big car compensation approach. Hey, we can't use beef, is the apparent thought process, So let's throw in every damn type of bean and vegetable imaginable. That method definitely gets you textural as well as flavor variety, but it can become a bit too jumbled. Better to make a couple of well-balanced choices and focus on perfecting them. Kidney beans are a must in my chilies. I grew up with kidney beans in my chili, and I will continue to enjoy them in my chili. You, on the other hand, are free to substitute whatever type of bean you want. There's certainly something to be said for dried beans, and I do sometimes opt to brine dried beans overnight to make chili 100% from scratch. But canned beans are a sure thing. They're never over or undercooked. They're never bloated or busted. They are lacking in the flavor department, but with a good simmer and a very flavorful liquid, you can easily make up for this. And the great thing is that the liquid base for chili is naturally low in pH. Both the chilies and the tomatoes are acidic, and beans and vegetables soften very slowly in acidic liquid. This means you can simmer your canned beans for a significant period of time in your chili before they really start to break down. But what about more texture? I tried using a mixture of kidney beans and other smaller beans and grains, chickpeas, flageolets, barley, but the real key turned out to be using the food processor. By pulsing a couple cans of chickpeas in the food processor, I was able to roughly chop them into a mixture of big chunks and tiny pieces. Adding this to my chili gave it great body and a ton of textural contrast. Amping up flavor. The key to rich flavor in vegetable chili is twofold. First, a long simmer during which water is driven off so that flavors are concentrated and various volatile compounds break down and then recombine to add complexity. And second, a good source of glutamic acid, the chemical responsible for the flavor we recognize as savory, sometimes called umami. So, time to reach for the umami bombs again. Anchovies are out of the picture for obvious reasons, but a touch of Marmite and soy sauce adds a ton of richness to the chili. Other than that, the flavor base is pretty straightforward. Onions sweated in a little vegetable oil, garlic, oregano, the dried stuff is fine for long cooking applications like this, and a couple of canned chipotle chilies in adobo sauce to add a touch of smokiness and heat, compensating nicely for the lack of browned beef. Finally, as we saw with our meaty short rib chili, there are certain aromas that are carried well with steam, while others are actually carried better via vaporized alcohol. My chili has got plenty of liquid in it, so the steam bit's covered. Adding a couple shots of booze just before serving takes care of the rest. I like bourbon or whiskey, because I've usually got it around, but cognac, tequila, or vodka will work well. Just make sure that it's at least 80 proof, 40% alcohol by volume, and unsweetened. The truth of the matter is that the key to great vegetarian chili is to completely forget that you're working on a vegetarian chili. Chili greatness lies in the careful layering of real chilies, textural contrast in each bite, and a rich, thick consistency packed with savory flavor. Whether it's made with beans, beef, pork, ground yak hearts, for that matter, if you get the basics right, you're off to a good start. Texas chili con carne. Okay, folks, this is it. The real deal. For all of you Texans who turned your noses up or rolled your eyes at my bean-filled chili recipe, I will make it up to you. This recipe is real deal chili con carne, old school Texas style. What does this mean? First of all, absolutely no beans and no tomatoes. Indeed, there's very little that goes into the pot other than beef and chilies, and plenty of both. That doesn't mean there aren't a few things to discuss, however. Let's get to it. The meat. The original chili was made with dried beef, pounded together with suet and dried chilies into a sort of pemmican-like dry mix, intended to last a long time and be quick and nutritious for cowboys to rehydrate and stew up out on the range. These days, we've got refrigerators and fresh meat, so we use them. What we're looking for here is a meat that's good for stewing, that is, rich in connective tissue and fat and high in flavor. In general, beef falls across a spectrum of tenderness, with a relatively bland but tender cuts on one end and the very flavorful but tough cuts on the other. These cuts generally correspond with the muscles that the steers use least to most during their life. So, On the far left side would be relatively unworked muscles like tenderloin and loin cuts, strip steak, porterhouse, etc., very tender but relatively flavorless. On the other end of the spectrum are hard-working muscles like short ribs, shin, oxtail, and chuck, shoulder. Chuck is the ideal stew cut, with great flavor, a good amount of fat, and plenty of connective tissue in one well-balanced package. As the meat slowly cooks down in flavorful liquid, all of that connective tissue, mostly composed of the protein collagen, breaks down into rich gelatin, which is what gives good stewed beef its luxurious texture. Cut and sear. The chili of my youth was made with ground beef, which is key if you don't want to spend the time to properly stew your meat. Grinding beef shortens its fibers, making it far more tender, and ground beef chili can be ready to eat in under an hour. But that's not what we're after here. Real Texas chili is made with big chunks of meat and requires long, slow stewing. I played around with a few different sizes and settled on 2-inch chunks. They shrink to about 1.5 inches after cooking. I like having to shred a large cube of beef apart with my spoon before eating it, if only to remind myself how perfectly tender the meat has become. As for searing, as we know, there's always a trade-off. Searing helps develop nice browned flavors via the Maillard reaction, but it also results in tougher, drier meat. At the high temperatures required for browning, meat muscle fibers contract greatly and expel so much liquid that even after a long simmer in the pot, the edges of the meat cubes are relatively dry. I vastly prefer the softer texture of unseared meat. The solution? You could sear large chunks of meat, as I did, for the short rib chili with beans. But here's another solution. Brown only half the meat. You develop plenty of browned flavor, but retain good texture in the rest of the meat. Worried that the flavor will be concentrated only in the meat that you sear? Don't sweat it. Most of those flavorful compounds are water-soluble, meaning that there's plenty of time for them to dissolve and distribute themselves throughout the chili as it cooks. We already know how to make the most of chilies, so I won't bang your head against it again. Okay, maybe one last time. 1. Use fresh, dried chilies, not chili powder. 2. Toast the chilies, then simmer them in liquid, and, finally, blend them to prevent any grittiness in the final product. And that's about it. Beef, chilies, and thyme are all it takes. I occasionally add an onion and perhaps a few cloves of garlic that I sauté in the pot after braising the beef. If I'm feeling feisty, I may also add a few spices from the rack. Cumin, cinnamon, allspice, a bit of dried oregano. All are good in small quantities, but totally optional. Texans, please don't kill me. The only question left is how to stew the meat. Ideally, you want to cook the meat at as low a temperature as possible to avoid causing undue muscle fiber contraction while still softening its connective tissues. The easiest way to do this is to use a very large, heavy pot with plenty of surface area for evaporation. This helps limit the chili's maximum temperature, and to use as low a flame as possible on the stovetop, or, better yet, put the pot into a low-temperature oven, 200 degrees to 250 degrees Fahrenheit is good, which will heat more gently and evenly than a burner. Leaving the lid slightly ajar reduces vapor pressure on the surface of the stew, which can also limit its upper temperature. With a heavy lid, stew temperatures can push up to 212 degrees Fahrenheit. Leave that same lid slightly cracked, and your stew will stay closer to 190 degrees or even 180 degrees Fahrenheit. Much better. Even slow-cooked meat can be overcooked, so you want to carefully monitor your chili and pull it off the heat just when the meat becomes tender. This usually takes 2.5 to 3 hours. Then you can leave the chili as is, but I like to thicken mine with a bit of cornmeal. Like any good marriage, the marriage between beef and chili gets better and more intimate with time. Let the chili sit overnight in the fridge, and it'll taste even better the next day. I promise, it's worth the wait. Meaty? Check. Hot, rich, complex chili flavor? Check. And that's really all Texas chili needs. A sprinkle of cilantro, sliced scallions, and perhaps some grated cheese. I like cotija, but Jack, Colby, and cheddar will all work fine. Make for good accompaniments. As do warm tortillas or corn chips. As does some good beer or whiskey. And fine, if you'd like, you can go ahead and add a can of beans. Just don't tell anyone I told you to. Chili verde. We all know that chili is thick, rich, spicy, meaty, complex, and red, right? But what about green chili, that equally complex, fresher, porkier cousin common to many southwestern states? The most basic and hardcore version of New Mexico chili verde is made by simmering rich cuts of pork in a thick stew of roasted hatch chilies, onions, garlic, salt, and little else. As the meat is braised until tender, the broth picks up the flavor of the melted pork fat, along with the uniquely sweet and bitter taste of the chilies, made smoky from roasting until nearly blackened. Grown in the town of Hatch, population 2,000, in southern New Mexico, these chilies provide a complex backbone that few other single ingredients can. I don't spend much time in New Mexico. I have a thing about heat and dream catchers. And fresh Hatch chilies rarely make their way to the Northeast, which leaves me with canned or frozen chilies. But neither of these two roast particularly well, and that smoky char is the best part of green chili. Luckily, I also don't place much credence in authenticity. I'll settle for delicious. I live far enough away from New Mexico that, hopefully, I'll be able to see the dust trail roused up by the violently inclined green chili fanatics approaching and beat a hasty retreat. The peppers. It's certainly possible to get some form of Hatch chili to your door, no matter where you live. The internet is rife with Hatch chili distributors, promising to ship you authentic canned or frozen peppers straight from the source. The problem with these is not really a texture or flavor problem. It's that canned or previously frozen chilies are downright impossible to char properly before stewing them. They're simply too wet. And pre-roasted canned or frozen chilies don't have the deep flavor of home-roasted chilies, which left me with one option: find some suitable substitutes. Poblano peppers were an obvious place to start. They're readily available, and they have a deep, earthy flavor. To add a bit of brightness and some of those characteristic bitter notes to the mix, I also added a few Cubanelle peppers. A couple of jalapenos, with their heat and grassiness, rounded things out. If you want to go for full-on smoke, you can light a fire in an outdoor grill and roast your chilies over the glowing embers until completely blackened all over. For us apartment dwellers, roasting them over an open gas flame or under a broiler works just as well. The goal here is total carbonization of the exterior. As it heats, the liquid just under the surface converts to steam, forcing the skin outward and away from the flesh. This small area of air and water vapor just under the skin insulates the flesh underneath, preventing it from burning. After the peppers are completely blackened, the loosened skin slips right off, leaving the flesh clean and uncharred, but infused with deep, smoky flavor from the charred skin. The tomatillos. Even among the less zealous chili heads out there, tomatillos are a point of contention. Although tomatillos are a member of the same family as tomatoes, though completely different from unripe green tomatoes, it's actually most closely related to gooseberries. The flavors of the two, dominated by a citrus-like tartness with a distinct savory finish, are remarkably similar as well, though gooseberries tend to be sweeter. One of the great things about tomatillos is that they are also quite high in pectin, the sugar-based gelling agent that is the primary thickener in most jellies. If you include tomatillos, you don't really need any other thickener in your chili. Many classic tomatillo-less recipes call for flour or another starch, and the tartness it brings to the party is a welcome flavor addition as well. I char mine under the broiler to maximize that smoky aroma. It's in recipes like these when the importance of every detail really comes out. Charring every surface of the chilies to maximize smokiness. Carefully monitoring your roasting tomatillos so that they char and soften while still retaining some of their fresh acidity. Sometimes the process of slowly, deliberately building flavors is just as rewarding as the finished dish. The pork. Red chili is all about beef, but with green chili, pork is king. I tried a few different cuts, including sirloin, belly, country-style ribs, and shoulder. The shoulder and sirloin fared the best, maintaining moisture and flavor throughout the cooking. The belly was simply too fatty, and while parts of the ribs were great, other sections cut nearer to the lean loin of the pig were much too dry. Pork shoulder requires a bit more work than sirloin to get ready for stewing, boning, trimming away excess fat, but it's significantly cheaper, which gives it an edge in my book. In my previous chili experiments, I'd found that browning small pieces of meat is a very inefficient method, and that it's much better to brown whole cuts or cut them up afterward. With shoulder, that's a little more difficult. You basically have to dismantle the whole thing to clean and bone it properly. My solution? Use the same method I use for the Texas chili con carne. Rather than browning all of the pork, brown only half of it, but allow the pot to develop a rich, deep brown fond before adding the onions and the rest of the pork. The coloring built up by the first batch of pork is more than adequate to give the finished dish a rich, meaty flavor. On top of that, the tender texture of the unbrowned pork is far superior to that of the browned stuff. Stovetop versus oven. The only question remaining was how to cook the dish. Oftentimes, for short simmered sauces, I'll do them directly on the stovetop, just keeping an eye on them as they cook to prevent them from burning. However, for braised dishes that need to be cooked for upward of 3 or 4 hours, the oven shows a couple of distinct advantages. On the stovetop, the stew cooks only from the bottom, which can lead to food burning on the bottom of the pot if you aren't careful. An oven mitigates this by heating from all sides at the same time. Moreover, a gas or electric flame set at a certain heat level is a constant energy output system, meaning that at any given time, it is adding energy to the pot above it at a set rate. An oven, on the other hand, is a constant temperature system. That is, it's got a thermostat that controls the temperature of the air inside, adding energy only as needed in order to keep the temperature in the same basic range. That means that whether you are cooking a giant pot of stew or the Derek Zoolander stew for ants, it'll cook at the same rate from beginning to end. For these reasons, it's better to use the oven for long, thick braises. Here's another question we touched on earlier. Lid on or lid off? If you believe the classical wisdom, you want your lid on as tightly as possible in order to preserve moisture. And more moisture in the pot means more moisture in the meat, right? Unfortunately, that's not really how braising works. Basically, when you are braising, there are two counteracting forces that you need to balance. Collagen breakdown, the conversion of tough connective tissue into soft gelatin, begins slowly at around 140 degrees Fahrenheit and increases at an exponential rate as the temperature goes up. Pork shoulder cooked at 140 degrees Fahrenheit might take 2 days to fully soften, while at 180 degrees Fahrenheit, the time is cut down to a few hours. On the other hand, muscle fibers tighten and squeeze out moisture as they are heated, beginning at around 130 degrees Fahrenheit and getting worse as the temperature rises. Unlike collagen breakdown, which takes both time and heat to take place, the muscle squeezing happens almost instantaneously. Meat that has been heated to 180 degrees Fahrenheit for even 1 second will be wrung dry. Like an unstoppable force meeting an immovable object, it's nearly impossible to achieve collagen breakdown without simultaneously squeezing muscle fibers. The good news: the gelatin created by collagen breakdown goes a long way to mitigating the drying effects of tightening muscle fibers. But the real key to a well-cooked braise is to cook it at a low temperature so that the meat doesn't enter the so-tight even gelatin can't save it range. Now we all know that water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, right? But, interestingly enough, even in a 250 degree Fahrenheit oven, you can greatly affect the temperature of the water inside a pot by allowing evaporation or not. This is because evaporation, the act of converting water into steam, takes so much energy. It takes more than 500 times as much energy to convert 1 gram of water into steam as it does to raise that same gram of water's temperature by 1 degree. Check out braising temperature versus time in the bonus PDF, which demonstrates the braising temperature of a pot with a lid sealed versus that with a lid left slightly ajar. With the lid closed, the liquid inside the pot hovers around boiling temperature, sometimes even rising above it. The pressure from the tightly sealed heavy lid allows the liquid to go above its regular boiling point, just as in a pressure cooker. So the meat ends up overcooking, and by the time it is tender, it's also relatively dry and stringy. The uncovered pot, on the other hand, stays a good 20 degrees lower, keeping the meat inside at a temperature far closer to the ideal. The meat gets tender and retains moisture as it cooks, giving us a far juicier, more tender end result. Don't you just hate that? You try your hardest to be cool and just write about the joys of slow-cooking pork, then a graph has to go and sneak its way into the works. Graphs are always doing that to me. My apologies. It is the food lab, after all. Anyhow, at least now you understand exactly why your pork chili verde is so deeply flavored, succulent, and complex. 3. Steaks, chops, chicken, fish, and the science of fast-cooking foods. Question: what do McDonald's and the most expensive steakhouse in New York have in common? Answer: they're both fast food restaurants. Wait, what? How so? Well, both specialize in fast cooking methods. That is, cooking methods designed simply to bring cuts of meat to the desired serving temperature while perhaps adding some nice browned flavor to the exterior. Fast cooking methods include pan searing, grilling, broiling, and sautéing, and they are reserved for tender cuts of meat like prime rib, pork chops, chicken breasts, beefsteaks, lamb chops, and yes, hamburgers. They differ from slow cooking methods, which are designed not only to heat foods, but also to heat them gently enough and for long enough to allow connective tissues to slowly break down. Slow cooking methods include true barbecuing, that is, smoking, and braising. Some cooking methods, such as roasting, steaming, or simmering, can be used for any cut of meat, though the temperature and time period you apply them for will vary depending on what you are cooking. We'll get to those slower methods in later chapters. Steakhouses, just like fast food restaurants, are all about speed. Unlike other types of restaurants, where many dishes and their components are prepared in advance and finished to order, steakhouses start pretty much solely with raw ingredients, slapping them on the hot grill or under a mammoth broiler only after you place your order. Grilling, pan searing, and broiling are among the most ancient of cooking methods, and they bring out the primal urge in all of us. How many of you can resist a hot ribeye steak fresh out of the pan with a crisp, well-charred crust and a juicy medium-rare center dripping with juices? Go on, raise your hands. I thought so. Many people see a meal at a steakhouse as the ultimate night out, the way to celebrate that big promotion or graduation, a means to reaffirm your dominance in the food chain, a once-a-year splurge to be taken with plenty of red wine, creamed spinach, hash browns, and brandy at a time when neither your significant other nor your doctor can say peep. This is my life, my day, my meat, you silently tell yourself as you bang your fat steak knife on the table, toppling that neat tower of asparagus into its pool of creamy hollandaise. But here's a little secret. There's nothing those steakhouses do that you can't do better at home and cheaper. All it takes is a bit of science, know-how, and practice. In this chapter, we'll not only talk about how to roast the tenderest, crispest on the outside, juiciest on the inside, melt-in-your-mouthiest prime rib roast to feed a whole crowd of hungry carnivores, but we'll also address the fast part of fast cooking methods, that is, steaks, chops, chicken breasts, and other proteins that can go from fridge to table in 30 minutes or less. Are you ready? The Food Lab's Complete Guide to Beefsteaks. I've cooked a lot of beef in my life, from steak for two to entire 25-pound prime-grade, grass-fed, dry-aged, grain-finished, well-marbled 7 rib racks. Beautiful hunks of meat that have left my apartment permanently perfumed with the sweet, musky scent of crisp beef fat, and my mind permanently stained with the insatiable desire to taste that beef again. This is not an altogether unpleasant state of affairs to be in my line of work. But wait, prime grade, grain finished, marbled? What do all these terms mean, you cry? And more important, why should I care? Here are the answers to every question you've ever had or might ever have about beef roasts and steaks. What exactly are the differences between a roast and steak? Do they come from different parts of the cow? Put most simply, a roast is a large piece of meat, generally at least 2 inches thick, that is cooked in the oven and sliced before serving. A steak is a thinner piece of meat, 2 inches thick or under, intended to be cooked and served as is. Practically speaking, there's not much difference between the two other than size. Both roasts and steaks are cooked via fast cooking methods. That is, when cooking them, the intent is to get the meat up to a specific final temperature and then serve it, as opposed to slow cooking methods like braising, which require you to hold meat at a given temperature long enough that connective tissues can break down. Because of this, cuts used for roasts and steaks must come from parts of the cow that are relatively tender to begin with. In many cases, the cuts of beef used for roasts and steaks overlap. For instance, a ribeye or Delmonico steak is essentially simply a single-bone rib roast, and a tenderloin steak or filet mignon is a steak-sized slice of a tenderloin roast or Chateaubriand. The four high-end steaks you should know. I'm looking to buy some good steak. What do I need to know? As mentioned before, the difference between a steak and roast essentially comes down to size. Any good roast can be cut into individual steaks, while cheaper cuts like sirloin, flank, and skirt, and chefy cuts like hanger and flat iron are becoming increasingly popular and available these days. The kings of the steakhouse are still those cuts that come from the longissimus dorsi and the psoas major muscles. The longissimus dorsi are a pair of long, tender muscles that run down either side of the spine of the steer, outside the ribs, all the way from the neck to the hip. The psoas major are a pair of shorter muscles that start about two-thirds of the way down the steer's spine and run on the opposite side of the ribs to the longissimus, the inside. Commonly referred to as the filet mignon or tenderloin, the psoas major are by far the tenderest meat on the steer. That, coupled with their small size, makes them the most expensive cut. That whole supply and demand thing, you know? Out of these two muscles come a number of different steaks. The chart in the bonus PDF shows what you'll find at the typical butcher shop. Why would I want to eat steaks from these muscles? The tenderness of a steak is inversely related to the amount of work that the muscle does during the steer's lifetime. So, as relatively unused muscles, the longissimus dorsi, commonly referred to as the loin or backstrap, and the psoas major are extremely tender, making them ideal candidates for steak, and also quite expensive. The former has an advantage over the latter in that it contains a generous amount of fat, both in large swaths around the central eye of meat and, more important, within the muscle itself in a web-like network known as marbling. Why is marbling important? Mainly because it lubricates the muscle fibers. At room or fridge temperature, the fat is solid, but when cooked, it melts, helping muscle fibers slip around each other more easily as you chew, resulting in more tender, juicier meat. Marbling is also important because most of the flavor in red meats comes from the fat. Indeed, there are studies in which tasters fed portions of lean beef and lean lamb were unable to identify them correctly, but were easily able to do so when given a portion with fat. Fatty beef just tastes beefier. Grading. What do the labels from the government on my beef telling me that it's prime or choice mean? The USDA grades beef into 8 categories: prime, choice, select, standard, commercial, utility, cutter, and canner. The top 3 are the only ones you are likely to see fresh at the supermarket. The rest are used for packaged foods and other products. If you ever see a steakhouse advertising 100% utility-grade beef, run, screaming! Prime-grade beef is the USDA's highest designation. It comes from younger cattle, under 42 months of age, and is highly marbled, with firm flesh. Less than 2% of the beef produced in the United States gets this designation, and the vast majority of it goes to steakhouses and fancy hotels. If you happen to find some at your butcher, make sure to thank him. Choice-grade beef has less marbling and tenderness than prime beef. If cooked right, though, it'll still be plenty juicy and flavorful. For low-fat cuts like tenderloin or certain sirloin steaks, you can expect the meat quality to be nearly indistinguishable from that of prime beef. This is the standard option at high-end supermarkets. Select-grade beef is much leaner than prime or choice, but still tender and high in quality. Its main drawback is its relative lack of marbling, so it will not be as juicy or flavorful as higher grades. Standard and commercial-grade beef can be found in some supermarkets, but will be sold as ungraded. It's often the choice for generic store-brand beef, and it shows very little marbling and is markedly tougher than other grades. Avoid it. Utility, cutter, and canner are almost never sold retail. You can get them in the form of beef sticks, jerky, or preformed burgers, or in the fillings of things like frozen burritos or sausages. Prime-grade beef is so expensive and difficult to find. Is it really worth seeking out? Good question. I held a blind beef tasting, pitting choice-grade beef against prime, cooking both in the exact same manner and to the same temperature. Oh, the horrors I put up with in the name of science! Of the 8 tasters present, there was an overwhelming and unanimous preference for the prime-grade beef, though the choice was still quite tasty. Prime generally costs about 25% more per pound than choice, which is a hefty chunk of change if you're feeding a crowd. In my household, though, steak night is a rare occasion, and one that I save up for. What about this Kobe beef I keep hearing about? Kobe beef is a type of high-quality, well-marbled beef named after a professional basketball player. Wait, strike that. Reverse it. True Kobe beef comes from Tajima-breed Wagyu cows. This is a breed that was originally a work animal used to plow rice fields in the mountainous Hyogo Prefecture of Japan. Once beef started to become more popular in Japan, some people noticed that meat from these cows had an unusually high level of marbling and a distinct, delicate flavor. The cows were consequently carefully bred to maximize these characteristics. The result is beef that is absolutely stunning in the degree of marbling it has, far outstripping even USDA prime beef. But Kobe beef is difficult to come by even in Japan, and depending on the import laws at the moment, it is impossible, or at least illegal, to find true Kobe beef in the United States. What you're far more likely to see is Kobe-style beef, most of which comes from domestic animals crossbred from Wagyu and Angus cattle. Meat from our domestic Kobe beef tends to be leaner, darker, and stronger in flavor than its Japanese counterpart, an artifact of their Angus lineage and their American-style grass and grain feed. Good American Kobe-style beef is usually the most expensive beef on the market. Incidentally, if you ever see someone offering Kobe burgers, kindly refrain from ordering them. Kobe beef is prized for its marbling, tenderness, and subtle flavor. Burgers already have plenty of fat and tenderness because of their grind, and subtle flavor is not what you want in a hamburger. It's a marketing gimmick, pure and simple. And yes, Kobe Bryant really is named after the beef. Color and size. How come when I buy beef, sometimes it appears purple and sometimes deep red? Should I select one over the other? Here's the reason. It has to do with the conversion of one of the muscle pigments, myoglobin, and its exposure to oxygen. Immediately after being cut, meat is a dark purplish color, the color of myoglobin. Soon, oxygen begins to interact with the iron in myoglobin, converting it to oxymyoglobin, which has a bright cherry red color. Have you ever noticed how when you cut into a rare steak in an oxygen-rich environment, like your house, it starts out dark, then blooms into redness? Now try the same thing in the vacuum of outer space. See the difference? So, even though the bright red color is the one most associated with freshness, it's really got nothing to do with it. Purple meat can be just as fresh. You are particularly likely to notice this dark color in vacuum-sealed meat. Eventually, enzymes present in the meat will cause both myoglobin and oxymyoglobin to lose an electron, forming a pigment called metmyoglobin. It's got a dirty brown, gray, green color. While it doesn't necessarily indicate spoilage, it does mean that the beef has been sitting around for a while. Do you mean to tell me that the color of red meat doesn't come from blood? Precisely that. The beef you buy in the supermarket contains little to no blood, which is drained out immediately after slaughter. Blood contains a pigment very similar to oxymyoglobin called hemoglobin. So, next time your friend orders his beef bloody rare, you can correct him saying, "Don't you mean rare enough that the myoglobin pigment in the muscle has not yet had a chance to break down?" Say that, then duck. People who eat bloody red beef tend to have anger management issues. Labels: natural, grass-fed, and organic. Labeling laws in the United States are confusing at the very least, and in many cases worthless. And bear in mind that it's not in the best interest of the vast majority of beef producers to make the labeling any clearer. The less the consumer knows about how meat gets on their table, the better. The majority of cattle in this country are raised on pasture for most of their lives, though when pastured, their diets are supplemented with corn and other grains. They are almost all finished for the last few months in high-density feedlots, where they are fed a grain-based, mostly corn and soy, diet in order to promote the marbling and fattiness we find so appealing. They are routinely treated with prophylactic antibiotics, not just to stave off diseases, but also to promote faster growth. Regular cattle are not particularly happy animals for the last couple months of their lives. Fortunately, there are alternatives at the supermarket. Here are a few labels you might see and what they mean. Natural means basically nothing. There's no enforcement. There are no rules. It's basically an honor system on the producer's part, and no third party checks it. Naturally raised, on the other hand, does mean something. As of 2009, the label ensures that the animals are free of growth promotants and antibiotics, except coccidiostats for parasites, and that they were never fed animal byproducts. What this means in practical terms is that you can be assured that the meat is free of any antibiotic residue and that the cattle were raised in clean, relatively uncramped environments designed to prevent them from ever needing antibiotics. Organic beef is certified and inspected by the government, and the animals must be fed completely organic feed grains and be antibiotic and hormone-free. They must also have access to pasture, though in reality, access could be a single patch of grass on the far side of a large dirt feedlot. Organic cattle are also subject to stricter enforcement in terms of humane treatment. More recent legislation mandates that at least 30% of their dry matter intake needs to come from pasture for 120 days out of the year. That's good news. Grass-fed cattle must, at some point in their lives, have been raised on a diet of grass. They do not necessarily receive a 100% grass diet, nor are they necessarily finished on grass. Most grass-fed cattle are fed grain for their last few weeks to fatten them. The very definition of what grass means is also open to debate. Many producers want to include young corn stalks under the grass umbrella, effectively diluting the label. I generally choose well-marbled organic or naturally raised beef, if possible, from specific ranches that I know do a good job with their cows. Next time you're in the supermarket, take a look at the labels, write down the names of the producers, and look them up on the internet. You'll be amazed at what information a little Googling can get you. Is grass-fed beef really healthier than grain-fed? Many studies indicate that it is. It's certainly healthier for the cow, a ruminant animal whose digestive system has evolved to break down grass. Then again, even grain-finished cows are only finished on grain for a few months before they are slaughtered. Hardly enough time to put them at risk of serious health problems, so I'm frankly not too concerned about that argument. According to Marion Nessel, a professor of nutrition and public health at NYU, grass-fed cows tend to have lower levels of E. coli, as well as lower levels of dangerous bacteria in their feces, and require fewer antibiotics, making them, all in all, safer to consume. They also tend to have higher levels of omega-3 fatty acids, that's the healthy stuff, along with higher levels of transconjugated linoleic acids, CLAs. Wait, aren't CLAs a trans fat, and aren't trans fats bad for you? Yes, indeedy. The very same trans fats that occur in artificially hydrogenated fats are present in the meat of all ruminants, like cattle, sheep, and goat. However, there is some indication that CLAs from cows are actually healthier than the artificial trans fats in hydrogenated oils, though it's unclear whether it is real nutritionists who think this, or perhaps just the folks from the Beef Council. As with most matters related to nutrition, the literature seems to indicate that nobody really knows what the heck is going on. I'm getting tired of all this talk about health and nutrition. What about flavor? Grass-fed beef, in general, has a more robust, slightly gamier flavor than grain-fed beef. And if it's grain-finished, it can be just as tender and moist. Personally, I try and find beef from a producer who has allowed the cattle to graze for the majority of their lives on pasture, then finish them with a supplemental grain. Most of mine comes from Creekstone Farms, which supplies a lot of the beef at Pat LaFrieda, New York's most well-known meat purveyor. Your best bet is to get to know your butcher and talk to him about what you want. How you balance flavor, nutrition, and ethics is up to you. Buying tenderloin steaks. Is it true that in tenderloin steaks, marbling and aging are not as much of a factor? Yep, it's true. Tenderloin is one of the leanest cuts of beef, so even prime-grade tenderloin won't have an excessive amount of fat. It's known more for its tenderness than for its flavor. In fact, when purchasing tenderloin, I normally don't bother paying for anything beyond choice grade. Proper aging of tenderloin is also nearly impossible, for the simple fact that it does not have enough surrounding fat for it to be dry-aged without going rancid or drying out. Tenderloin that's labeled aged is almost guaranteed to have been wet-aged, that is, aged in a cryovac bag, which will improve tenderness but not flavor. When buying tenderloin steaks, there are two ways to go about it. You can buy already butchered steaks, which are almost invariably too thin to cook properly, or worse, unevenly shaped and sized. Much better is ask your butcher for a whole 2-pound center-cut roast, also called a Chateaubriand. This is tenderloin from which the skinny and fat ends have been trimmed off. You can then cut it into perfectly even steaks yourself when you take it home. This is enough meat to feed 4 Americans or a half dozen Europeans. For more on this, check out how to trim a whole beef tenderloin. Reasonably sized pan-seared steaks. You'll understand the title of this section when you get to unreasonably large pan-seared steaks. Chicken might be more popular than beef at the supermarket these days. We'll get to quick cooking chicken recipes here too, but we're still a nation of beef eaters. Is there anything that strikes us on a more basic, carnal, primal level than a perfectly marbled hunk of medium-rare beef with a juicy, rosy pink center and a deep, dark, crisply browned crust? Bacon and sex, perhaps, in that order. But that's it. It's why we fork over top dollar at steakhouses on a nightly basis. But as I mentioned at the beginning of the chapter, they're not doing anything in those kitchens that you can't do yourself at home. You just need to know two things: how to buy a good steak and how to cook it. As for buying, we've already covered all the basics. Here's a quick recap of what you're looking for. Well-marbled meat. If you buy conventional meat, look for prime or at the very least choice grade. If you prefer organic or grass-fed, look for plenty of intramuscular fat. Fresh meat that's been cleanly butchered. If the display case that's in front of the customers looks messy, imagine what it looks like back in the meat cutting room. Aged steaks, if you can afford them. Unless you like your meat well done, you're also best off buying thick-cut steaks, that is, at least 1.5 inches thick, so that you have plenty of time to develop a nice sear on the outside before the interior has a chance to overcook. It's better to buy one bigger, thick-cut steak and serve 2 people perfectly cooked meat than to buy 2 thinner steaks and serve 2 people overcooked meat. Congratulations! Now that you've got a great steak in your kitchen, you've won 80% of the battle. The only thing left to do is not mess it up. Here are some commonly asked questions about cooking steak and the answers. When should I salt my steak? Read a half dozen cookbooks or listen to a half dozen celebrity chefs, and you're likely to hear at least as many different responses about when you should salt your meat. Some claim that salting immediately before putting it in the pan is best. Others opt not to salt the meat at all, instead salting the pan and placing the meat on top of the salt. Still others insist on salting up to a few days in advance. Who's right? To test this, I bought myself 6 thick-cut bone-in ribeyes. I love the smile butchers get in their eyes when you do this, and salted them at different 10-minute intervals before searing them 1 at a time in a hot skillet. So the last steak went into the pan immediately after salting, while the first steak went in a full 50 minutes after salting. All of the steaks were allowed to stand at room temperature for the full 50 minutes, ensuring that they were all at the same starting temperature when cooking began. The results? The steak that was salted immediately before cooking and those that were salted 40 or 50 minutes ahead turned out far better than those that were salted at any point in between. What was up with those steaks? Here's what happens. Immediately after salting, the salt rests on the surface of the meat, undissolved. All the steak's juices are still inside the muscle fibers, so searing at this stage results in a clean, hard sear. Within 3 or 4 minutes, the salt, through the process of osmosis, will begin to draw out liquid from the beef, and this liquid beads up on the surface of the meat. Try to sear at this point, and you waste valuable heat energy simply evaporating this pooled liquid. The pan temperature drops, your sear is not as hard, and crust development and flavor-building Maillard-Browning reactions are inhibited. At around 10 to 15 minutes, the brine formed by the salt dissolving in the meat's juices will begin to break down the muscle structure of the beef, causing it to become much more absorptive. Then the brine begins to slowly work its way back into the meat. After 40 minutes, most of the liquid has been reabsorbed into the meat. A small degree of evaporation has also occurred, causing the meat to be ever so slightly more concentrated in flavor. Not only that, but I found that even once the liquid has been reabsorbed, it doesn't stop there. As the meat continues to rest past 40 minutes, the salt will slowly work its way deeper and deeper into its muscle structure, giving you built-in seasoning beyond just the outer surface you get if cooking right after salting. The absolute best steak I had was one that I salted on both sides and allowed to rest, uncovered, on a rack in the refrigerator overnight. It appeared to dry out slightly, but that was only superficial. The amount of drying that occurs with overnight rest, about 5% moisture loss, is negligible compared to the amount of moisture driven off during cooking, upward of 20% or even more in the hard seared edges. And after cooking, the steak that had been salted and rested overnight actually ended up with 2% more moisture than one that was salted and cooked immediately due to the beef's increased ability to retain water as the salt loosened the muscle structure. Also, as the salt makes its way back into the meat in the longer salted steaks, the meat becomes a deeper color. That's because the dissolved proteins scatter light differently than they did when they were still whole. Moral of the story: if you've got the time, salt your meat for at least 40 minutes and up to overnight before cooking. If you haven't got 40 minutes, it's better to season immediately before cooking. Cooking the steak anywhere between 3 and 40 minutes after salting is the worst way to do it. What about salting even further in advance? Any benefit there? Actually, yes. Salting your steak up to 3 days before you plan to cook it, while letting it rest uncovered on a rack set in a rimmed baking sheet in the fridge, is called dry brining, and it will improve your steak in 3 very noticeable ways. First, as the steak sits, the salt will slowly continue to work its way into the meat, seasoning it more deeply. Second, as that salt works its way in, it will continue to break down muscle proteins, allowing your steak to retain more moisture when you cook it. This leads to juicier steaks. Third, and most important, resting your steak uncovered will allow the very outer edges to dry out a bit. This may sound like a bad thing, but keep this in mind. That moisture is all moisture you're going to drive out when searing your steak anyway. Getting it out of the way before your steak hits the pan means that you get more efficient browning. Better browning equals better flavor, and faster browning equals less overcooked meat under the surface of the steak. What exactly is searing, and does it really seal in juices? Since the mid-19th century up until recently, it was believed, and is still believed by many, that searing a piece of meat, that is, exposing it to extremely high heat in order to rapidly cook its exterior, would cauterize the pores in its surface, thereby sealing it and reducing moisture loss. Let me say straight off the bat, the theory is false, and it's exceedingly simple to test. Here's what you do. 1. Take 2 identical steaks and measure their raw weight. 2. Cook 1 steak by first searing it in a hot skillet, then transferring it to a 275 degree Fahrenheit oven to cook through to an internal temperature of 125 degrees Fahrenheit. Remove it from the oven and allow it to rest for 10 minutes, during which time its internal temperature should rise by about 5 degrees to 130 degrees Fahrenheit, then fall again. Weigh this steak and note the amount of weight loss, which translates to fat and moisture loss. 3. Now cook the second steak by first placing it in the oven until it reaches an internal temperature of around 115 degrees Fahrenheit, then transfer it to a blazing hot skillet and cook, flipping occasionally until it's nicely browned and has reached an internal temperature of 125 degrees Fahrenheit. Allow it to rest, same as the first steak, then weigh it and note the amount of weight loss. Both steaks have been exposed to searing and roasting, and both steaks have been cooked to the exact same final temperature. The only difference is the order in which the operations were carried out. Now, if there were any truth at all to the searing locks in juices theory, we'd expect that the steak that was seared then roasted will have retained more juices than the steak that was roasted then seared. In reality, however, both steaks lose a fairly similar amount of juice. And, if you repeat the experiment, in most cases, the roasted then seared steak will actually stay juicier. This is due to the fact that a cold steak going into a hot skillet takes longer to sear than a steak warm from the oven going into a hot skillet does. The extreme heat of a skillet is great for developing browned flavors, but it also causes muscle proteins to contract violently, squeezing out juices. For juicier steaks, the less time you spend at high heat, the better. So why do we bother searing at all? It's simple. Flavor. The high heat of searing triggers the cascade of chemical reactions known as the Maillard reaction. I've referred to this elsewhere, but here's a quick recap. Named after Louis Camille Maillard, the scientist who discovered it, the Maillard reaction is the complex series of chemical reactions that causes foods to brown. It's often confused with caramelization. That steak has a beautifully caramelized crust. But in fact, the two reactions are distinct. Caramelization occurs when sugars are heated, while the Maillard reaction occurs when sugars and proteins are heated. The places you're most likely to see it are when searing or roasting meat, meat contains natural sugars, when baking bread or making a piece of toast, flour contains carbohydrates built with sugars and proteins, or when roasting coffee beans. Although Maillard reactions can occur at relatively low temperatures, they are glacially slow until your food reaches around 350 degrees Fahrenheit. That's why boiled foods, which have an upper limit of 212 degrees Fahrenheit, determined by the boiling point of water, will never brown. With high temperature searing, frying, or roasting, however, browning is abundant. First, a carbohydrate reacts with an amino acid, the building blocks of protein, which then continues to react, forming literally hundreds of byproducts that will in turn react with each other to form still more byproducts. To this day, the exact set of reactions that occurs when Maillard browning takes place has not been fully mapped out or understood. What we do understand is this. It's darn delicious. Not only does it increase the savoriness of foods, but it also adds complexity and a depth of flavor not present in raw foods or foods cooked at too low a temperature. That's why your steak tastes so much meatier when it's properly browned. And that's why, for most people, the outer crust of the meat is the tastiest part. I've read that letting your meat come to room temperature before cooking gives you better results. Any truth in that? Let's break this down one issue at a time. First, the internal temperature. While it's true that slowly bringing a steak up to its final serving temperature will promote more even cooking, the reality is that letting it rest at room temperature accomplishes almost nothing. To test this, I pulled a single 15-ounce New York strip steak out of the refrigerator, cut it in half, placed half back in the fridge, and the other half on a ceramic plate on the counter. The steak started at 38 degrees Fahrenheit, and the ambient air in my kitchen was at 70 degrees Fahrenheit. I then took temperature readings of its core every 10 minutes. After the first 20 minutes, the time that many chefs and books will recommend you let a steak rest at room temperature, the center of the steak had risen to a whopping 39.8 degrees Fahrenheit, not even a full 2 degrees. So I let it go longer, 30 minutes, 50 minutes, 1 hour and 20 minutes. After 1 hour and 50 minutes, the steak was up to 49.6 degrees Fahrenheit in the center, still colder than the cold water that comes out of my tap in the summer, and only about 13% closer to its target temperature of a medium-rare 130 degrees Fahrenheit than the steak in the fridge. After 2 hours, I decided I'd reached the limit of what is practical and had gone far beyond what any book or chef recommends, so I cooked the two steaks side by side. For the sake of this test, I cooked them directly over hot coals until seared, then shifted them over to the cool side to finish. Not only did they come up to their final temperature at nearly the same time, I was aiming for 130 degrees Fahrenheit, but they also showed the same relative evenness of cooking, and they both seared at the same rate. Long story short, pulling your steaks out early is a waste of time. What's the best fat to use? Now we're ready to start cooking. But before the steak hits the pan, we've got to add some fat. When searing, fat accomplishes two goals. First, it prevents things from sticking to the pan by providing a lubricating layer between the meat and the hot metal. Did you know that meat proteins actually form a chemical bond at the molecular level with metal when they are heated in contact with it? Proper preheating and using fat will help prevent this from happening. Second, fat conducts the heat evenly over the entire bottom surface of the steak. It may not look so from afar, but the surface of a piece of meat is very bumpy, and these bumps only get exaggerated as the meat is heated and starts shrinking and buckling. Without oil, only tiny bits of the steak will actually come in direct contact with the hot pan, and you will end up with a spotty sear, almost burnt in some spots and gray in others. You need to use at least enough oil to conduct heat to the portions of the steak that are not in direct contact with the metal. But what's the best medium to sear in? Butter or oil? And if I'm using oil, which one? Some claim that a mixture of both is best, using the rationale that butter alone has too low a smoke point. It begins to burn and turn black at temperatures too low to properly sear meat. Somehow, cutting the butter with a bit of oil is supposed to raise this smoke point. Unfortunately, that's not true. When we say that butter is burnt, we're not really talking about the butter as a whole. We're talking specifically about the milk proteins in butter, the little white specks you see when you melt it. It's these milk proteins that burn when you get them too hot. And believe me, they couldn't care less whether they're being burnt in butterfat or in oil. Either way, they burn. What all this means is that the best cooking medium for a steak is plain old oil, at least to start. Adding butter to the pan a minute or two before you finish cooking is not a bad idea. This is just long enough to allow a buttery flavor and texture to coat the meat, but not so long that the butter will burn excessively, producing acrid undertones. There are some who keep bottles and bottles of various oils on hand for different cooking projects. I limit my oils to a more reasonable three. One is a high-quality extra virgin olive oil that I use for flavoring dishes. One is the peanut oil I use for deep frying. And the third is the canola oil I use for pretty much all of my other cooking projects. Canola oil has a reasonably high smoke point, making it great for searing. But, more important, it has a very neutral flavor and is inexpensive, with neither the corniness that comes with corn oil or the high prices that come with safflower, grapeseed, and many other oils. How often should I be flipping my steak? There's a problem when it comes to cooking steak, and it has to do with your two conflicting goals. You see, for most folks, the ideal internal temperature of a finished steak is around 130 degrees Fahrenheit, medium rare. This is the stage at which it's rosy pink, tender, and juicy. But you also want a deep brown, crispy, crackly crust, a byproduct of the Maillard reaction. A few years ago, food scientist Harold McGee published an article in the New York Times that mentioned an interesting technique, multiple flips. It goes against all classical and backyard wisdom. We all know you should only flip a steak, or a burger for that matter, once, right? I mean, how can you even ask that question? Well, I've always been of the mind that if an answer exists, and clearly there is an answer to this, the question is worth asking. Fortunately, the question is one that's fairly straightforward to test. Those on the one flip side claim more even cooking and better flavor development as the selling points of the method. Curiously, the few people on the multiple flip side claim the exact same benefits from multiple flips, adding shortened cooking time to the mix. So, who's right? I cooked a few different steaks to the same internal temperature of 130 degrees Fahrenheit. One was flipped just once, another was flipped every minute, a third every 30 seconds, and a fourth every 15 seconds. Interestingly, the steak that was flipped every 30 seconds reached the desired temperature the fastest of all four, followed by the one flipped every 15 seconds, followed by the one flipped every minute, and finally by the one flipped just once. The fastest cooking steak took about 2 minutes less than the slowest cooking one. Then I served them up to a few friends I had over for dinner, asking them to tell me which ones had the nicest crusts, which were the most evenly cooked, and which were the tastiest. From the outside, they had trouble telling them apart. The amount of browning seemed pretty close to equal. However, once we cut into them, the differences were more apparent. The steaks flipped only once had distinct bands of overcooked meat at the edges, while the ones flipped multiple times were more evenly cooked. It wasn't enough of a difference to make anyone say that one steak was particularly bad per se. They all got devoured. But it was enough to prove that those in the only flip it once camp have no basis in reality to back up their claims. More evenly cooked meat in a shorter period of time seems pretty win-win to me. If cooking via the single flip method, when you flip the steak over, the second side will be barely warmer than it was when the steak first went into the skillet. Your cooking is only halfway done. If you add more flips, on the other hand, what you are essentially doing is approximating cooking both sides of the steak simultaneously. Neat, right? Incidentally, the steak flipped every 15 seconds took longer than the steak flipped every 30 seconds because it spent too much time in the air above the pan rather than in direct contact with the pan itself. Moral of the story, all you supple-wristed crazy flippers out there, don't worry, you're doing the right thing. And for all you single flippers, well, you can keep doing what you're doing, and it probably won't hurt your steaks none, but lighten up a bit, will ya? What is carryover cooking, and how does it affect how I cook my meat? We know that meat cooks from the outside in, right? So, at any given moment, the exterior layers of your steak are hotter than the very center, where we take our temperature reading for doneness. Once you pull the steak out of the pan, though, heat energy from the outer layers of meat has two places it can go, out or in. Most of that energy will dissipate into the air as the steak rests, but some of it will continue traveling into the meat. The result is that after you take a steak out of the pan or off the grill, its internal temperature will continue to rise. The amount it rises is determined by a number of factors, but the overriding one is the size of the steak or roast. A thin steak, say an inch thick or less, will barely rise a couple of degrees, but a big, fat 1.5 to 2 incher can rise